Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 56 of the NYC Real Estate Podcast. I'm Mark Levine. I'm your host. I'm also one of the owners of EBMG. We are a property management company specializing in co-op, condo, and residential rental buildings. And if just before I get into our guest today, who is Ed McCool, I'll introduce you all in a second. I wanted to let you know that you could reach out to the show at nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to check out my company, go to g.com, or you could call us 212-335-2723 extension 201. I'm always here to answer your questions. Be glad to hear from you. But now that we've got that out of the way, we've got a great guest who's been on the show before. We've got Ed McCool from McCool Risk Solutions. How are you, Ed?
I'm good, Mark. Thank you for the great intro.
No problem. So for everybody that hasn't listened to any of our podcasts before, do you want to just give a background on you and your firm so that you could kind of set the table to how we're going to get to the insurance discussion that we wanted to have today?
Absolutely. My firm specializes in community associations. So although my background says 1,500, we are now over 1,600. So that's kind of all we do. I've been doing this, it'll be 29 years in February. So this is, I've been in insurance for a very long time, and I have seen good times and bad times. And I think our podcast here is going to be going over the bad times, because right now it's absolutely enthusing. So.
Yeah. And I think we handle a lot of clients together. The two of us you are the broker for a lot of our corporate clients, and we probably have about half of our portfolio, at least with you. But I am seeing what you're seeing, and coming from a management standpoint to the insurance side of things, it is a disaster out there right now. And what we're dealing with on a weekly basis as we put out all of these proposals for all these renewals, we're seeing this. So I really wanted to bring you into this episode to kind of go over what the pain points that we're seeing just globally on our portfolios, which would also translate to everybody out there. And I know you're coming up on 30 years in September, which we're almost in a few days, I'll be at 25 years. And I was thinking this morning, I said, I don't know how we got here. I don't know how I'm in here 25 years. Like, I probably remember 10 years and thinking, oh God, like how much longer do I have to go? But we made it. We're keeping on going.
Listen, never boring.
Never boring. And I think we've learned a lot over the last few years, and hopefully we've put out some good information for those people out there as well. But okay, so getting back to insurance. So what I've seen on the insurance market is a real tightening of all of the coverages. And from my perspective, what I've seen, we used to have, if we were looking at it from the umbrella side, we had it so good, and we didn't realize that we had it so good a few years ago, because we would have in our master umbrella plan with our company, or, you know, even individualized, you would have buildings that would have like $100 million of an umbrella coverage for peanuts. And now it's totally flipped itself over. It's now inverted. Now it's like you could maybe get 2 million or 3 million in coverage on some buildings, and it's astronomical. Yeah, it's so crazy. So from an umbrella standpoint, like, what is the reasoning? Why don't we back up? Because there may be some people listening that don't exactly know what umbrella coverage is. So can you explain what the umbrella coverage is on any particular policy? And then can we move into what is the change that brought us to where we are today, where we're almost underwater with our coverage and the cost to provide it?
Commercial umbrella is basically extra liability insurance. So it's not property related. A lot of the time somebody will say, well, my building's underinsured at $10 million. We need $12 million, but that's okay. We have an umbrella. That is incorrect. An umbrella is simply liability based, and liability being lawsuits. So the way you think about it is you can't collect under your own liability. It's there to protect you if you're named in a lawsuit. So the umbrella is extra liability over your general liability. It's over the directors and officers' liability. It could be over auto liability and several other areas, but the main ones are the general liability and the directors and officers' liability. Like you said, you're wrong. 5 years, everybody had 100 million. If you had 50 million, people would look at you and say, well, why do you only have 50 million? And it was peanuts. And a lot of property management firms had programs that they banded together for all their insureds, and it was peanuts. And Days are over. Whether they'll ever come back, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'll get into why we're there, but let's just start with the overall insurance market so everybody understands. And everybody's probably heard this over the last couple of years. We're in a hard market right now, okay? Insurance is cyclical. There's soft markets and there's hard markets. And basically, insurance companies make money in two ways. One is the underwriting income, okay, which they basically, they charge an adequate premium to offset claims. They offset claims and expenses. And the second way they make money is they take that money and they invest it. That's the investment income. When an insurance company is making money on both sides, basically, it triggers what's called a soft market. Soft market insurance companies want more premium because they're making money on their investments, so they start lowering their premiums. And along with that, they're willing to reduce their guidelines. They look the other way at certain things like losses. Everybody's happy because rates go down. Maybe you were paying $20,000 last year. A new company comes in and quotes it at $18,000. Your current company doesn't want to lose it, so they give you a quote of $16,000. That's a soft market. And we see that every few years, and they tend to last longer than hard market. Right now, we're in a hard market, and that's exactly the opposite. Insurance company isn't charging enough money to offset the claims and expenses, and they're not making enough money on their investment income. So what do? They got to raise the premiums. And along with that, as they start tightening their guidelines, they have more restrictions. They will certainly bail out of the market, whereas maybe they were writing condos or cars last year. All of a sudden, they don't want to do it right now. Okay, so that all of a sudden rates skyrocket, and it becomes more and more difficult for insurers to get insurance and get competitive insurance. And that's where we've been for the last few years. And it started with the umbrellas and the liability side. And we're still seeing more. I mean, most hard markets are usually 2 to 3 years. We're in year four at this point. And I don't see it stopping. Sadly, I'm not going to wait to the end to say that. I don't see that we're done in 2023 or 2024. I still see that we're going to have the issues. Now, in terms of the umbrella that you mentioned, there's really two reasons why the umbrellas have had problems. One is strictly New York based, and the other one is countrywide. So let's just start with New York. In New York, the labor laws are very unfriendly towards property owners. And by labor law, what I mean is claims resulting from them, which are typically an injury to a contractor or a contractor's employee. So in New York, there's two labor laws that really hold the property owner responsible for injuries to these contractors. It doesn't make a difference if there's negligence on that part. So anytime someone is off the ground, basically, and there is an injury, the association of the property owner is held ultimately responsible. And so it's very difficult to get out of these claims, go push these claims back off on these contractors. And we started to see more and more over the last 7 or 8 or 9 years, more and more seven-figure lawsuits. Whereas it used to be smaller, 100,000, 200,000, now we're seeing million-dollar claims, $1 million and up. So anytime it goes over $1 million, it pierces the umbrella. Okay, so the umbrellas have started to see more and more of these labor law claims that are hitting the books. And that is one of the reasons why they have really either raised premiums or lowered their limits, or both. And that's what you see. So these umbrellas are not just one company. So if you have a $100 million umbrella, you don't have $100 million with one company. What you have is that is a program that was put together by a program manager. So the insured is the program manager, and then the buildings are sub-insureds under, let's say. Well, there may be four different companies, or five or six different companies. Maybe Chubb has the first $25 million. Another company has the next $25 million, and so on. Well, if one of those companies bails out, the umbrella is going to have a problem, especially if it's the first layer. And that's what we've started to see. Companies have pulled out of the umbrella marketplace. They have started saying, well, we're not writing $25 million anymore. We'll give you $5 million. Well, $5 million, if you have another layer on top that used to be on top of $25 million, they don't want to drop down to the $6 million. So programs have been falling apart. Or reducing their layers. Now, countrywide, the insurance companies have seen many, many more claims that have pierced or exceed the $1 million limit and are piercing the umbrella. They call it social inflation. Juries really just kind of throwing money around, whether it's a distrust of insurance companies or whatever it is. It's just the claims are much higher and the payouts are much higher now. So they're hitting the umbrella much more often. And that's the second reason. And that's countrywide. That's not strictly New York. That is all over the country. And so, again, the umbrellas have decided, well, we're either going to charge more, we're going to have a lower limit, or we're getting out of it totally. And that's what we see.
So I could see that there's some sort of a parallel with the exterior, like with New York City, especially with them mandating certain work on the outside of buildings, maybe at a greater frequency or at a more like minutia based. Let's say for Local Law 11, you had to do like a certain amount of drops, and now you have to do a lot more over the last few cycles. And so that leads to more time on a scaffold or a bridge, and that leads to more possibility of getting hurt. Like, that's the real one thing that I've seen in the last year or two is our the majority of the claims that I've seen have come from exterior work that we've had people hurt, injured. Unfortunately, you know, you hear of stories where people have passed away. And it could be falling off of a second story bridge, or it could be all the way at the top. It doesn't matter. A fall is a fall. So I can see that there is some sort of relation now with like needing to do these extra things with all of these buildings. And then your exposure is obviously greater. So that's leading to more claims. And now that's pushing up the market for everybody else.
It is.
Now, in terms of the, okay, so we've covered the umbrella, and now we understand that the umbrella market is such that it's going to be very expensive for a little bit amount of coverage, and that relates to whatever claims you've had in the past, and I'm assuming that they're looking at everything. Are they also looking at potential work that you have coming up in the future, or do they just look at the past? Okay.
They do. They want to know. I mean, there's plenty of companies now who specifically will ask, are you planning on doing work? And if you do, then they want to see what type of work. They want to see the contract that you're hiring, their insurance information, and other info. So the best thing an insurance company could do, or an insured can do, is make sure they have proper risk transfer, which means, okay, well, the contractor that you're hiring has insurance. It's adequate and doesn't have the exclusions the insurance companies don't want to see. So, for example, the big issue in New York is when a contractor is injured, they're suing the association. Well, with workers' compensation, an employee can't sue their employer. So if a contractor employee gets hurt on the job, can't sue his employer, but he can sue the property owner or the association, and that's what's happening. So if there's proper risk transfer, there's a contract in place that puts the onus back on the contractor. If the contractor has adequate insurance and no exclusions, then they name the property owner or association as additional insured, at least the insurance companies have a chance of sometimes putting this back on the contractor. So yes, they're asking, and they want to see all this information up front. And if you can't provide it, they may not provide you with a quote.
Okay. So another thing that you just brought up kind of tickled my brain, where you said that the contractor's insurance policy is looked at as also part of this whole process of figuring it out. The other thing that I'm seeing lately are the insurance companies requiring certain coverages by contractors that work in the building. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, what I've seen is that a lot of the smaller contractors don't have those policies in place, or they have exclusions in their policies, which would prohibit them under these new guidelines by the insurance companies. So not only are we getting increases on the insurance side, but now, because of, if we circle it back to the people that we use in each building and the required coverages that they are needing to have now to work in the building, we're pricing ourselves out of the lower price people because they can't come in because they can't afford the coverage that they need. So now we have to go to, instead of maybe the B or C priced contractors, and go to the B or A. And it's going to be both more expensive on your insurance side, not yours, but the insurance carrier side, but also on the vendor side, because now you need to get a vendor that can afford to have all these coverages put into place and go through that whole process. Is that fair to say?
It is. I mean, there's no doubt it's catch 22. I mean, if they have the right coverage, well, you're probably going to pay more. And realistically, the main exclusion is called third party action over. What it is it provides coverage for their employee who's injured. So as I was saying before, is the employee can't sue their employer, they can sue the association. Well, the association and the insurance carrier is trying to put it back on the contractor, but if he has an exclusion for injury to employees, it doesn't make a difference if you're successful in putting it back on. Their insurance policy won't cover it. And so, yes, and that coverage tends to be very expensive. I tell people it's probably five times the insurance premium. So if I see a contractor who's got a $5,000 premium policy, it's probably $25,000 to have that coverage in there. So yes, it's catch 22. Now, the problem is again, these claims in New York are astronomical, and it doesn't need to be necessarily. I mean, a lot of them are height related and work outdoors, But I've seen some claims that have been doozies. One was inside, they had a water damage claim. They fixed it. Insurance company wanted the stairwell scraped and painted. And so they hired someone for like $600. That's all, just to scrape and paint this one little area. Well, he didn't have a ladder, so he stood on a paint can because he couldn't reach something. Couldn't reach it. He put a second paint can on top.
Oh, no.
And then he fell and he was injured. And it was a bad injury.
Yeah.
Ended up $4 million later. So it's a $4 million claim. That entity, that property owner, their insurance premium went from $50,000 to $250,000. And I know that lasted for about 5 years. So in the long run, it cost them well over $1 million in insurance premiums just because they hired someone who didn't have insurance and they weren't able to transfer risk. So yes, it's a catch-22. You're probably going to pay more to your contract and you can't get the handyman you're used to getting. But in the long run, it's going to be helpful.
Wow. So that really puts into place that every minor decision could lead to a catastrophic cost moving forward. So really be careful. And I know that you guys, because we've dealt with you, with your firm on some of these where we have buildings that we work together on where the vendor will submit something and we'll send it over to your office and you'll give us the guidelines if they're good to go or if there needs to be changes. So as part of your services, I think that's like appreciated that you have the staff in there to do that. In terms of, so I know we started at the umbrella side of things. I have a few other questions that are related to either existing policies renewing or new policies. One thing that I noticed is when we change from one broker to another on a new policy, it almost seems very rushed. Let's say it's September 1st when the policy is due and then you're changing and maybe loss runs are being held up by the old agent, which we could go into. And then suddenly we get them and we have to make a snap decision. And it's not that we can go out and say, well, we've got so much time and we're flexible. It's insurance coverage. You need to have it. So it could be August 29th or August 30th when everything gets put into place for that September 1. Is that something that is industry-wide? Is that something that the prior agent, if you know, handing over more information quickly, we could get ahead? Like what is the main function of like this time period and how much time should we have in a perfect scenario?
Need a minute. Yeah.
Oh, I think we lost you.
Okay. All right. I'm back here. All right. So, you know, it's typically not the insurance broker's fault most. And yes, there are times the insurance broker delays, and yes, there are times where they will hold back a loss run. But the truth is, a lot of the times where it's going down to the wire, it's simply because insurance companies don't always have the quotes on a timely fashion. Okay. There are instances. You may get the incumbent. So if you're with an insurance company and they're providing a renewal quote, they may give us 30 days and say, here you go, here's your quote. But if we're out there and remarketing it to other carriers, it's probably going to take a lot longer than that, especially in this market. No one's happy right now. Everyone's seeing premium increases. So what are they doing? They're taking their insurance and they're remarketing it out. And so you have these insurance companies who are just absolutely overloaded. And so they are looking at, most of the time, they're looking at it in date order. I have boards that'll come to me and say, hey, listen, we want this quote 60 days in advance. And the only thing I can do is laugh at that. It is impossible. We would love to get all the quotes out and off our desk and away and see it, but it is impossible. So a lot of the times these insurance companies are overloaded and they look at, okay, well, if you have a September 1st renewal, they may not be looking at these things until August 15th. And we may provide them with all the information they need. And then, okay, well, then they start looking at it on August 15th. Then they have questions. I mean, they didn't ask the question 60 days ago when they got the submission. Now they're asking. Now we have to get this information. So a lot of the times when it goes down to the wire, it is not the insurance broker's fault. I know it is frustrating. It is tough. And right now, the way the market is it's just every company is absolutely overloaded with submissions. And nothing is really done timely. So it's tough.
And from prior conversations, maybe I think it was with you. It might not have been, and I apologize if it wasn't. But I know that when we remarket out, it's not really advised to go year to year, keep bouncing around and trying to remarket, because that is when the insurance companies say, well, they're just looking to bounce to the lowest price. We want long-term relationships with these clients. So how often do you recommend actually going out to the market and putting it out with other carriers besides the incumbent?
In a normal market, I see every 3 years or so. You definitely, like you said, you don't want to go every year because an insurance company has to hold on to an account for a few years before it becomes profitable for them. And so if they're seeing the same submission come in every year, they're thinking two things. One, okay, well, we've seen this last year. We didn't get it. We quoted it 2 years ago. We didn't get it. What are the chances we quoted this year and get it? And so they know the odds of them getting it are lower. On the flip side, what they say is, okay, well, they remarket it every year. So even if we do get it, they're probably going to remarket it again next year and we're going to possibly lose it. And so they don't want that. So yes, you're 100% right. You should not remarket every year. There are plenty of associations that do that. And you kind of putting yourself in a bad position because that insurance company, when you do need them, isn't going to want to provide a quote.
Right.
So I say every 3 years or so. It depends on the building. It depends on the instance. Right now, there's associations who are shopping every year, and I can't blame them. We shop them every year. You have more accounts now that are in E&S market, which is excess and surplus lines, which means they're non-admitted, which means they're not licensed in New York State. They may be there because they have claims or violations, et cetera. And so we're remarketing it every year because we want to get them back into a direct market that specializes in co-ops and condos. Larger buildings typically will shop more often than the smaller buildings. On the flip side of that, there's not a lot of companies for larger buildings. You take a building that's insured for $200 million, let's say, there may be only two companies for provide quotes. So sometimes it doesn't make sense to shop it every year if you're with one of those two companies, knowing that there isn't too many options out there. Smaller right. buildings, there's probably more insurance companies for. But on the flip side, if I have, let's say, a 20-unit building, I can quote most of the companies in-house, and I know if there's something more competitive out there. So I would say 3 years unless two things are happening. One, you're being non-renewed by the insurance company, okay? Then you got to get it out there. Or two, you're seeing an increase of more than 10%. Now, in New York, an insurance company, by law, has to provide at least 60 days notice if they're going to raise your premiums by 10% or more. So you will get that notice. If you get that notice, it should be remarketed out.
Okay. So talking about remarketing, we go through this process a lot where we'll look to whether it's a non-renewal because they want to get out of the building or we're just shopping it around. But there are certain things that the insurance carriers will look at when they come in and inspect the building, both on all of the databases that are available for violations and just building information, certificate of occupancy, open permits, open violations, as I said. So this is a change that I've really seen in the last few years where, and really even the last year or two, where carriers are saying, we can't insure you at this level because there's open violations on either HPD or DOB. And then they give you, in some cases, a certain amount of time to rectify it, or you hope that you can do it by the next time. But can you kind of guide me through that process and what the typical fallout of a building keeping on these violations that they should be clearing? And some of the violations could go back to the 1980s. Like I've seen violations that like predate like almost my childhood. And they're just still sitting there because they've never been taken off, but it's obviously important to do so. Can you kind of explain that process of what they're looking for and what the financial implications could be if we have open violations sitting on a building's account?
Yes. Okay. So 5 years ago, more than that, insurance companies really didn't look at the violations. And so all of a sudden over the last couple of years, and some did, but most didn't, it really wasn't factored in. But now pretty much everyone is. And it started with the umbrellas saying, okay, well, we got violations here and they feel it's a reflection on the building if they're not addressing these. So you have different violations. Some of them may not really be taken into consideration too deeply. Something like a class A examples, which would be no peephole in the entrance door of a unit, let's say, no street number on the front of the building, things like that. Then you got class B violations, which are hazardous violations, such as inadequate lighting. Then you got class C, which are immediately hazardous, rodents, inadequate supply of heat, water, et cetera. Any of those, and I can tell you now, you're not going to get a quote from the good insurance companies or the direct markets because they need to be rectified. So violations are one area that more and more insureds are really taking a look at because it could be very, very costly. And sometimes the violations are things that really may not be that difficult to handle, or may they make time. but they do need to be addressed. Now, that's not the only thing. When we're out there remarketing, yes, the insurance company is looking at violations. It's very easy for them to go on these websites and pull them down, but they're also looking for compliance of loss control recommendations. So more and more insurance companies, they want to make sure that you have proper life safety, let's say. It may be your building, but at the end of the day, if they're your insurance company and there's a claim, they're the ones who have to pay it. So we're seeing more and more, hey, we want emergency lights in the hallway. They're doing more to take a deeper look at the electric. So you have these Federal Pacific stab lock circuit breakers that a lot of buildings have that are known to be defective. The insurance companies, if they find you have them, they're either getting off the risk immediately or they're issuing notice cancellation at the end of the year unless you get these replaced. And it's, sometimes it's very costly. If you have a building that's got 100 units and they got a panel downstairs, plus all the apartments have these circuit breakers, it could be very costly to remove them. It has to be done, though, because there are very few insurance companies who will want to write it. So you may end up paying more in premium than it would cost to remove this to upgrade the electric.
I know in the past that there were a bunch of buildings that I was privy to that had just chosen to stay with their insurance broker or insurance carrier because they had these Federal Pacific and they understand the cost of doing everything together. And at that time, they made the decision that the, you know, for the cost benefit analysis, that it just made sense right now to stay put rather than bringing in somebody else to do an inspection, find this out, have to upgrade or upgrade emergency lighting, and then have an additional increase on the premium. So when you're inviting the wolf into the hen house, per se, you know, you're, it's just like inviting DOB into your building when you are trying to clear some violations. You don't know what else they're going to find. And that's the important thing. And you also mentioned the recommendations, and whenever we get these recommendations, they could be something like uneven sidewalk, you know, make sure that there's no tripping hazards. It could be the Federal Pacific stab lock breakers that you were just talking about. It could be, you know, emergency lighting, whatever that is, the recommendations. And I know, I believe I've spoken to you about this in the past, probably privately when we were dealing with other building matters. The recommendations are not really recommendations. The recommendations are requirements.
They are.
Yeah. So you could say, oh, it was recommended that we do this, but push come to shove, you do that, you don't do it, you're putting yourself in a real negative position in the future.
You are. And that's the problem, is as much as a lot of buildings have said, we're not going to remarket this year, we're going to stay where we are. And a lot do that, and you can't blame them. The problem with that is eventually when you do have to go out to market, the insurance company may cancel them for a different reason. And when you do go out to market, the new insurance companies, they know, okay, well, they have stab locks or they have issues with the sidewalk and they won't provide a quote. So again, they may not be there when you need them. And so it's kind of a catch 22. So the violations and issues with the loss control requirements should be addressed over the course of time and be preventative in that case, because when you do go out to market, you do want to know that, okay, well, if there's 10 companies who are normally willing to quote, that you can get quotes from 10 companies. If you're going out and all those 9 of them are declining and you only have one quote, well, that's where it becomes usually you pay a higher premium because it's a matter of supply and demand. So
yeah,
those things should be looked at in advance and some kind of plan to update and upgrade come into play. And the other thing is, if you are canceled, and there are insurance companies, so let's say the insurance company goes out, does an inspection, sees the sidewalks are in poor condition, and tells you to fix them. If you don't fix them timely, or if you don't fix them at all, they may issue notice cancellation. Now, when remarketing the insurance companies ask, has any policy been non-renewed by a prior insurance company in the last couple of years? If we answer yes, they want to know more about it. Sometimes the insurance companies in New York, they can cancel coverage in the first 60 days for any reason. So if there's an issue where an insurance company cancels coverage midterm, and now we have to remarket to another insurance company, that's the first thing they look at. Well, you had a March 1st effective date, the insurance company canceled it on April 13th. Why? Okay, well, they didn't comply with upgrading the stab lock, say, and it raises more than one red flag, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Are there certain things that as a building operator, we could look at globally across all of our buildings to put our properties in the best position for when they're inspected by the insurance agent or the insurance carrier yearly, or when we're remarketing the insurance? What flies off the top of your head besides tripping hazards, electrical upgrades? Is there anything that we could do to just put our best foot forward?
Well, those are the main ones there, but just normal housekeeping. I mean, a lot of times the insurance companies will see things that are in the fire escapes blocking somebody from being able to go down. They see that in the stairwells. So insurance company wants to know, okay, well, if there is an instance, people need to get out of the building. And so if they can't, that's going to be a fire hazard. Same thing with hazardous chemicals near that aren't stored properly. Most of it
Yeah.
boils down to life safety stuff. They want to see emergency lights. They want to see smoke detectors, things like that.
So it's the common sense, but it's also the legally required.
It is.
We have OSHA, we have FDNY, we have DOB, we have HPD, we have all these departments that we're responsible for maintaining the building in the way that they prescribe. So as long as we're doing that, we should be in okay shape. I always used to say that, throughout portfolio pricing, we'd be able to, when I would go into interviews for new buildings, I would always say we could save you money based on your current program because they were maybe not getting as much, pricing as we are at scale. And now I can't say that anymore. I could say the difference is I could say that we can save you from where your increase would have been, because we're seeing such big increases that we could lower it a little bit, but we can never anymore lower the pricing because the market just doesn't hold that anymore. And just watching 10 to 20% is standard these days for an increase. And the boards are rightly so losing their minds because they're not like honed in on this conversation every day. So I think that's really an important reason for us to also have this conversation is so that people are aware that the market is going up. It has been going up for a year or two. As you said, you don't see it really going anywhere down in the next year or two. We have to see past that where it's going. But the way that it is moving and the way that everything else ties into all these increasing costs, that, as I said before, you require more work, more accidents can happen. So it's feeding itself. It's a cycle of just insurance. And is there anything else that we missed talking about today that you wanted to cover? I hit my main points. I wanted to hit the umbrella. I wanted to hit the violations and anything else that could be like more of a stain on your building so that for pricing sake, is there anything else that is more timely topic that you want to discuss?
A couple of things. One, and you just kind of hit on it, that we're not done with the premium increases. And just I want them to understand what they're facing this year and probably next. And it's too early to talk about 2025, but now we're starting to see more and more of the building limits being increased or more increases in premium on the property side for two reasons. One, insurance companies have determined that the cost of materials has gone up, and which is resulting in the cost of the replacement cost of the building going up. So they're raising building limits. So, and it could be significant in some cases, 20, 30% an increase in the limit is going to reflect on the premium. Secondly, insurance companies have insurance companies themselves. They're called reinsurance companies. So let's say you have a building that's insured for $50 million. Well, the insurance company may not be putting out their entire $50 million. You may see $50 million, but they're only insuring it for $25 million, and then they're going to get reinsurance for the other $25 million. So that way that they're not putting too many of their eggs in one basket. Well, they have to pay the reinsurance company for this extra insurance, and the reinsurance companies are raising their rates. So if the reinsurance company raised their rates, it filters down to the insurance company who's got to raise their rates, which filters down from the insurance. So that's the reason why we're probably going to see more premium increases over the next year and a half or so, because the building limits are going to go up and the cost of the insurance is going to go up. That's number one. Some suggestions I have are increased deductibles. I still see properties who have a $2,500 deductible, a $3,000 deductible. Raise the deductible, go to $5,000 at a minimum. And sometimes it maybe makes sense to go to 10,000 or even more. Not only are you getting a discount or premium reduction, but it's keeping you from putting in the smaller claims. And that's what gets people in trouble. It's typically not that one large claim like a fire that gets you in trouble. It's five small water damage claims because the insurance company says, okay, well, we've had five claims. We really haven't paid anything out, but eventually we're going to pay something out. There's got to be plumbing issues. Or the same thing with trip and falls. If they keep seeing people slipping and falling, they're thinking, well, is the sidewalk in poor condition? Is the super not getting out there and salting it when it's snowing? And so again, the one larger claim is going to get you is not going to get you in as much trouble as the smaller claims. So you want to be able to take those away, and that's what the raising the deductible does. Now, what that also does is there are instances where an association with a high deductible, what they can do, I have associations that I insure that have raised their deductible to $25,000. And not because the premium savings was intriguing, it's because what they're doing is they assess the owners for the deductible when it happens. And owners who have homeowners insurance as a coverage called loss assessment under their HO6, which is a co-op or condominium unit owners policy, that provides coverage for an assessment that as long as it's a covered peril under the homeowner's policy. So you have more and more of these buildings who are taking a higher deductible and then assessing the owners, and the owners are submitting the assessment to their insurance companies, which are being paid. So these are things that can be done. Now, the problem with that is you just got to make sure insurance is maintained. We see more and more condos have two things. One, requirements for maintaining insurance, but also when an owner gets a mortgage in a condo, they have to supply proof of coverage. In the co-op, not so much. We don't see as many associations who require homeowners insurance. Plus, when a shareholder shows up at a closing, they don't have to show proof that they have insurance coverage. They have to show proof that the building has insurance coverage. So you've had plenty of co-op shareholders who don't have insurance because they weren't required to have it at closing. So we have more and more associations who are now amending their governing documents to require owners to have insurance. And what them having insurance does is it helps in a number of areas, including the loss assessment we just talked about.
Yeah. And we have a lot of buildings where we require yearly proof, but that's only as good as the day you got it, right? And it's the same as with the vendor. Yeah, we have this issue with a few vendors where they'll say, well, we submitted if somebody's doing a renovation. Well, we did a renovation for another apartment 6 months ago. You have it on file. And no, we need the existing policy because it was only as good as the day that it was posted. If coverage changed, or if it was lapsed, or if it expired, or you don't have it anymore, they could easily get around that by just saying, oh yeah, look at the old certificate, it's in play. So by keeping on top of the vendors every time that we do either work in the building, or a shareholder does an alteration, or by getting the homeowners renters insurance from the occupants once a year, that goes a long way. And a lot of the co-op closings that we have, if they have a mortgage, they are going to be usually required to have the cooperators insurance at the time of closing. And hopefully if they do have a mortgage and it lapses, they get notice from the company. But we are the backstop for that, where we can once a year ask for that information and then put that in our files.
Two things to just expand on what you're saying here. One, on the homeowner side, what we did is we formed a separate department that will, for a fee, will track the homeowner's insurance, which is required. And the good thing about that is it's not done once a year. It's done over the entire course of the entire year. So like you said, if you have, let's say, 80 units and you require it every year on January 1st and everybody submits proof of coverage, hey, that's great, but the 80 different people have 80 different expiration dates in Mark Levine's policy, and they lapse on January 19th, and nobody will know until next year. Well, the department that we have runs it continuously over the course of the year. So we request it one time in the beginning, and then we have everybody's expiration dates, and then we follow up with them over the course of the year, and we supply proof to the property manager firm or the board of who has complied, who hasn't. So there's more and more, I'm sure more and more the people are going to start doing this, so there'll be some recourse there. And secondly, you're 100% right about the vendors. You can't just use that certificate from 6 months ago or 8 months ago. Not only may it be expired, but the thing is you always want to be an additional insured under the contractor's insurance policy. And a lot of the times the way you are an additional insured, their policy reads that in order for you to be an additional insured, there's got to be something in writing basically a contract stating such. And so the contract is going to be between the party that's hiring them and them. So if an owner is hiring them, their contract is going to be between them, and it needs to state, well, that contractor needs to name EBMG and the association as additional insured. Well, when that contractor starts working for another owner, all bets are off on the first one. Well, they need to have an updated contract again between that shareholder or that owner and that vendor. So yes, it's always important to get updated certificates and more on these contractors.
There is a whole other episode here about renovations and hold harmless agreements and waivers and insurance policy and exclusion. So I think we just figured out what our next one will be down the line. I think that's like one that really has to be hit in the future. Well, cool. How many, just as a question, how many employees are you guys up to these days? How big is your staff?
50 now.
50. Yeah, we're about the same. Yeah, so good. I love watching. We're kind of growing in parallel, at the same. So it's been fun to kind of be on the ride, because there's only like so many well, for me anyway, there's only like so many people in there. You're in the same industry, but you're in a different part of the industry. Like, I like seeing the parallels of how we're growing, you know, over the last 20 years together. And I'm sure as we get older, somebody else will pick that up, but it's been a fun ride so far.
It has. I don't, you know, some days aren't as fun as others, especially in this market, but it's really interesting. Interesting. Yeah. It's never boring.
No boring days. Stories for days. Yeah. Exactly. Well, cool. So if I'll put all of your contact information, but if anybody wants to go, if you're still listening to Ed's website, it's McCool.com, McCoul.com. And you can always email Ed, and I know this by heart, EJ McCool@McCool.com. Just like me, he's pretty fast to respond, and I always appreciate, you know, having an ear to you directly. So thank you for that. And I thank you for coming on the podcast. I think this was a great episode. I got everything that I wanted answered, which is great. And I think now we have even the next episode ready to go when we're ready to do it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me, Mark. I do appreciate it.
No problem. And again, if you're still listening, you can email the show at nycrealestatepodcast@gmail.com. I'm Mark Levine, your host. It's been a pleasure. And we'll see you on the next episode.